About 12 years ago, 13 years ago, I was living in South London. We were living in South London, and I was a missionary pastor of a large church in South London, and we had a missions conference, and we brought back from around the world 21 of our missionaries for that particular missions conference, and we invited a guest speaker, somebody who was very close to me, somebody I valued as a friend from Malaysia, Dr. Joy Sivaratnam. And Dr. Joy, and Joy is a man's name, by the way, in Malaysia. Dr. Joy came and he spoke at the conference. And one of the things that I have longed for all of my life is to be more filled with the love of God. That's been a passion for me. I really mean it. That's what I want more than anything else in the world. And on the last night of the conference, all of our missionaries, or all the 21 of them who were there from all the continents of the world, were standing there, and Dr. Joy and his wife and one or two others were going to just pray for them one by one. And as the missionary pastor, I felt it was my responsibility to stand behind them and catch them if they fell down. And one by one, as they were ministered to, prayed for, prophesied over, they fell down. And until he'd prayed for all 21 of them, and then Dr. Joy went back on the platform. And I stood there, and I just felt so sad, because I wished he'd pray for me. And then somebody said, "What about Michael and Esther?" And so Dr. Joy came back off the platform and he came to me and he said to me something I will never forget for the rest of my life. He said, "Michael, you are an apostle of love." And I just want to say that is my passion, and I want to talk tonight about the love of God and about loving one another. And can I just say that after he'd said that, his lovely wife, Elsie, looked at me and said, "And Michael, I've got a word for you too. Listen to your wife more." I'd like to read tonight from 1 Corinthians. I think you know the chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. And then I'll read a couple of verses from John's Gospel, and I'll read a couple of verses from Galatians. "Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy, and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not speak or seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known. And now abide faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. John's Gospel, chapter 13, verses 34 and 35. Jesus speaking. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. And then two verses from Galatians 5, verses 22 and 23. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such, there is no law. Have you ever tried to work out what love is? Try to understand it. I don't know whether you've noticed that passage from Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 13, but it's divided into three parts. And the first part is verses 1 to 3, and it says that love is essential. Listen to what it says. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And then he goes on to some other gifts. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and I have all faith so that I can move mountains, if I haven't got love, I'm nothing. And there you've already got five gifts of the Spirit mentioned in the first two verses. And then in the third verse, though I bestow all of my goods to the poor, and I'm prepared to die for what I believe, give my body to be burned, if I have not love, it profits me nothing. And I think the simple statement here is, love is essential. And then Paul goes on to speak in verses 4 to 7, or write, about the expression of love. Love isn't just essential, it's expressive. And he says that love suffers long. It's kind. It doesn't envy. It doesn't parade itself. It's not puffed up. It isn't rude. It doesn't behave rudely. It doesn't think about its own. It's not easily provoked. It doesn't think evil. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes, endures all things. That's the expression of love. And then he goes on and he says something else in verses 8 to 13. He says, love is eternal. It never fails. Have you ever asked yourself the question, why is love greater than faith and hope? Can I tell you? God is the God of faith. He's the God of hope. But he is not the God of love. He is love. He gives faith He gives hope, but he is love. And that's why love is the greatest. One day you will receive what you had faith for. One day you will receive what you hoped for. And you will not need faith or hope in heaven. But love will be there because God is love. Isn't that amazing? That's why it's the greatest. You know, there are four amazing verses to me in the New Testament about love in 1 John. I'd like to read them to you one by one. Anyone who does not love his brother is not a child of God. That is an astounding statement. If you don't love your brother, you're not a child of God. Secondly, anyone who does not love remains in death. Thirdly, no one has ever seen God. But if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. And the fourth verse is 1 John 4:16. Whoever lives in love lives in God. Can you grasp something of what this is saying? Can I say to you that love is very practical? Love is, how can you say you love your brother if you shut up your heart when you see him in need? It's immensely practical. Let us not love in word only, but in deed and in truth, with action. I think the devil has done everything he possibly can to twist the meaning of love. Love has nothing to do with Bollywood or Hollywood. That's not where you find the meaning of love. Love is more than an emotion. It's more than a feeling. It's more than a passing fad or fantasy. Let me say something that Jesus said. He said, love one another. That is a commandment. You don't respond to a commandment with an emotion. You respond to a commandment with a decision of your will. I choose to love. Something that just comes on me at a certain time. I choose to love. I choose with my will to love. And when I do choose to love, there may well come with it emotion and feelings and all the other things. But the basis of love is that God first loved me and I choose, I make a decision to love. It's a decision of the will. You never respond to a commandment in the Bible with an emotion. You respond with a decision. I've been thinking about this for a long time. And yesterday I was thinking, oh dear, I've got to speak tomorrow night. And I'm thinking, Lord, what shall I say exactly? And as I was thinking, this thought came into my mind. I'd like just to share with you very briefly three of the languages of love. And the first one is encouragement. And the second one is forgiveness. Third one is compassion. I'd like to spend just a few moments, if I may. I won't take a long time. I'd like to illustrate, if I may, because that's how I learned to preach. I don't have much education. I don't have much background. I never went to university like some of you did. I've got a piece of paper for 1 year course in Bible school, which is about as valuable as the paper it's printed on. I have, to my great joy and credit, two GCSEs, one in English and the other in art, the two subjects that you need to be a preacher. And so when we lived in Java and in Madura, in the villages, I learned to preach like this. Bible verse, point, story. Bible verse, point, story. And that's the way I am. So I hope you aren't offended by that. I'm not one of your super intellectual types. I did go to Oxford by invitation to speak for 3 nights in the university. And the first night I tried to be clever. And after the first evening, one of the dons came to me, one of the professors came to me and said, "We didn't invite you to be clever, we invited you to come and tell us some stories." So there we are. Number one, encouragement. Let me tell you a story that happened to me. It happened in 1986. It was the first time I had cancer. It was bladder cancer. I didn't realize it was cancer. All I knew was that I kept on passing blood every time I went to the bathroom to pass water. And my dear wife, she would say to me, "Darling, please go and see a doctor." And every time she said that, I said, "No, I'm trusting God to heal me." And I want to tell you, it wasn't really faith, it was fear. And I've since discovered that when you have faith, you don't need to fear the doctor. Okay? But I was, I was afraid. And after about 3 months of this constant passing of fresh blood, I went to Singapore to speak in a convention called Full Gospel Businessmen's Convention, the National Convention of Singapore in the World Trade Center. And there were three of us who were speakers. One was a man called Bill Subritsky from New Zealand. Another was Kenneth Hagen from America. And I was the baby of the party, the junior. And after I'd spoken on the second day in a session, Bill Subritsky came to me, famous for his ministry and deliverance and healing. He said to me, "Michael, I have a burden to pray for you. Can I pray for you?" And I said, "Yes." And he laid his hands on me and began to pray. And as he prayed, I felt the most horrible, nauseating sensations. And I felt something down in the nether regions was doing something funny. And as he prayed, I just felt something wanted to come up out of me and to vomit and be ill. And after he'd finished praying, I thought, "Praise God, I'm healed." And I couldn't wait to get to the bathroom. And I went to the bathroom, and excuse me talking like this in a Western audience, but I went to the bathroom, and I passed fresh red blood. And I was deeply disappointed. And at the end of that convention, somebody took me to the airport. Graham Ung, the moderator of the Presbyterian Church. And he said to me on the way to the airport, "Michael, I've got a gift for you." And he gave me a book. And the book was entitled, "Don't Wait Till He's Dead." And the only word I saw was dead. And I thought, what kind of gift is that? And when I got on the flight that night, Singapore Airlines flight 318, in my normal seat, I sat in the seat, they always give me the same seat, and I felt really quite unwell. I didn't feel like eating a meal, I didn't feel like watching the movie. And I just sat there, and I thought, well, I'll have a look at this book. And the title of the book was Don't Wait Till He's Dead, but there was a subtitle bit, To Praise Him. And I discovered the book was about encouragement. And the first chapter was absolutely ordinary. There was nothing that got my attention at all. And the second chapter was even more ordinary. I've told the author that since. But at the end of the second chapter, there was a story. And I'd like to tell you that story. There was a Dutchman, a young man living in London, in Knightsbridge, and he worked for an art dealer in the Strand. And every morning he'd walk from Knightsbridge down across to the Mall and through Admiralty Arch and through Trafalgar Square into the Strand to work. And one morning, as he'd been doing this for quite a long time, a young English lady was walking in the same direction, and they got talking. And it became the regular daily thing that these two would walk from Knightsbridge to the Strand. And he began to fall in love with her. And one day he said to her, "Would you marry me?" And she said, "No." And that was the end of their friendship. And it broke his heart. And in desperation, he went into a small church, South London, and he tried to find some consolation. His father had been a minister in the Dutch Reformed Church, and he remembered his roots. And in that church, his testimony is that Jesus came and met with him, and he surrendered his life to Jesus. Not many months later, he felt it was time to leave London, and he went back to his native Holland to enter theological seminary because he wanted to be a minister. But after 18 months, he dropped out. He wasn't very good at studying. He couldn't handle all that was expected of him, and his passion was the poor. And he left the theological seminary and he began to work among the poor of Amsterdam. And he began to have some success. And some of the homeless and the poor began to come to Christ. And he began to form a church. And then the elders of the Dutch Reformed Church became angry. And they began to criticize him. He didn't do it the way they thought it should be done. They began to attack him publicly, and they made life very difficult. While he'd been in London, before he went back to Amsterdam, he'd been asked by several places to give his testimony, and in one place he gave his testimony, and the pastor of the church said, "This is the finest young evangelist I've ever heard speak." That pastor was Charles Spurgeon. And now this young theological student who's dropped out and who's caring for the poor, who's ministering to the needy, now he is discouraged. And he gave up. And he took a paintbrush and he began to paint. He didn't live that many years after this. And tragically, in a fit of melancholic depression, he cut off his ear and committed suicide. And we know him as Vincent van Gogh. And as I read this story, I read this sentence, and it just changed my life. Just imagine how he might have preached Christ if he could paint sunflowers with such sensitivity, and all for the lack of encouragement. Lost. And I got on my knees on that flight, the lights were out, and I just knelt there, and I just said, "Lord, I don't know what my problem is, but if you will heal me, I want to spend the rest of my life encouraging people." And that's become my passion. I'd like to read a story to you that moved me very much. Are there any school teachers present? If you're a school teacher, would you just stand up? Wow. Let's give them a clap. Come on. And in the balcony as well. Please take your seat. Miss Thompson was a school teacher who every year would say to her students, "Boys and girls, I love you all the same. I have no favorites." Teachers do have favorites. And what's worse, most teachers have students they simply don't like. I was one of those. Teddy Stallard was a boy that Miss Thompson simply didn't like. He didn't seem interested in school. He wore a deadpan expression on his face. His eyes were glassy and unfocused. And when she spoke to Teddy, he merely shrugged his shoulders. His clothes were mussed and his hair unkempt. He wasn't an attractive boy, and he certainly wasn't likable. Whenever she marked Teddy's papers, she got a certain perverse pleasure out of putting crosses next to wrong answers. And when she put F for failure at the top of the papers, she did it with flair. She should have known better. She had Teddy's records and she knew more about him than she wanted to admit. The records read, "First grade, Teddy shows promise with his work and attitude, but poor home situation. Second grade, Teddy could do better. Mother is seriously ill. He receives little help at home. Third grade, Teddy is a good boy, but too serious. He's a slow learner. His mother died this year. Fourth grade, Teddy is very slow but well-behaved. His father shows no interest." At Christmas, the boys and girls in Miss Thompson's class brought her presents, piled them on her desk, and crowded round to watch her open them. Among the presents was one from Teddy Stallard. She was surprised that he had brought her a gift. Teddy's gift was wrapped in brown paper, held together with scotch tape. On the paper were written the simple words, "For Miss Thompson from Teddy." When she opened Teddy's present, out fell a Gaudi rhinestone bracelet with half the stones missing and a bottle of cheap perfume. The other boys and girls began to giggle and smirk over Teddy's gifts. But Miss Thompson at least had enough sense to silence them by immediately putting on the bracelet and dotting some of the perfume on her wrist. Holding her wrist up for the other children to smell, she said, "Doesn't it smell lovely?" And the other children, taking their cue from the teacher, readily agreed with oohs and ahs. When school was over and the other children had left, Teddy lingered behind. He slowly came over to her desk and said softly, "Miss Thompson, Miss Thompson, you smell just like my mother. And her bracelet looks really pretty on you too. I'm glad you like my presents." When Teddy left, Miss Thompson got down on her knees and asked God to forgive her. The next day, when the children came to school, they were welcomed by a new teacher. Miss Thompson had become a different person. She was no longer just a teacher. She'd become an agent of God, committed to loving her children and doing things for them that would live on after her. She helped all the children, but especially the slow ones, and especially Teddy Stallard. By the end of that school year, Teddy showed dramatic improvement. He caught up with most of the students and was even ahead of some. Once the school year ended, Miss Thompson didn't hear from Teddy for a long time. Then one day she received a note that read, "Dear Miss Thompson, I wanted you to be the first to know. I will be graduating second in my class. Love, Teddy Stallard." 4 years later, another note came, "Dear Miss Thompson, they just told me I'll be graduating first in my class.
I wanted you to be the first to know. The university has not been easy, but I've had 4 good years. Love, Teddy Stallard. And 4 years later, dear Miss Thompson, as of today, I am Theodore Stallard, medical doctor. How about that? I wanted you to be the first to know. I'm getting married next month, the 27th to be exact. I want you to come and sit where my mother would sit if she were alive. You are the only family I have now. Dad died last year. Love, Teddy Stallard. Miss Thompson went to the wedding and sat where Teddy's mother would have sat. She deserved to be there. She'd done something for Teddy that he could never forget. Can I challenge you tonight and tell you that love encourages people? Would you begin to do that with God's help? The second thing I want to say, and I'm aware of the time, is forgiveness. I'd like to kind of define forgiveness for you. Forgiveness in Greek in the New Testament is a word called aphiemi, and some of you scholars would know better than I if that's the way you say it. And it means to release somebody. Another definition is not to blame anybody anymore for things that happened. To no longer blame. To release. To let go of. Can I say to you that forgiveness does not make the wrong right? That's important. If it was wrong, it's wrong. Joseph, when he forgave his brothers, did not excuse them the wrong, but he totally forgave them. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Can I suggest to you that forgiveness is a decision of the will as well? Forgive one another is also a commandment. One day I was in Amsterdam and I was sitting with one or two of the YWAM leaders, and one of them said to me, Michael, in the story of the unjust steward, Jesus said that we are to forgive 70 times 7. Is that for one sin or for 70 times 7 sins? And I was taken aback and I thought about it and I said, well, I guess in the context it is for one sin. And then the man speaking to me, Floyd, said to me, therefore, we have to keep on forgiving for the same sin, don't we? And I said, well, I guess so. He said, it begins with a decision, but somehow we have made forgiveness a blasé type of thing. You just make a decision, that's it. It is not as simple as that. And sometimes you need to keep on forgiving. And then he said this, and if you get nothing else tonight, would you take this home? He said, forgiveness is the antiseptic that keeps the wound clean until God completes the healing. How often do you apply antiseptic cream or ointment to a wound? As often as is necessary until the healing is complete. What a principle. Now, may I tell you another story, a brief one? It happened in South Africa. It's a true story. It made me cry when I first heard it. A frail black lady was in the courtroom, and in front of her was Mr. Van der Broek. He'd just been found guilty of the deaths of her son and her husband. Some years earlier, he had come and taken the son, shot him at point-blank range, and they had set the son's body on fire while they parted nearby. And then he came for her husband. And for 2 years, she had no idea where he was. And then one day, he came for her. And he took her to a place by the riverside. And there she saw her husband laying on a pile of wood, bound, but his spirit unbroken. And the last words she heard him say as they poured petrol over him and set him alight were, "Father, forgive." And now she stands in the courtroom, frail, 70 years old, and a member of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Committee asked her a question. What would you like to happen to this man who has so terribly destroyed your family? And this is her response. She said, "I would like you to take me to the place where my husband died, and I'd like to gather up the dust and give his remains a proper burial. Secondly, I would like that Mr. van der Broek become my son. My husband and son were the only family I had. I would like him to come to the ghetto twice a month so that I can pour out on him whatever love I still have remaining in me. And thirdly, and my husband also wants this, I would like someone to take me and lead me across the courtroom to Mr. van der Broek so that I can embrace him and tell him that he is truly forgiven." And at that moment, friends, neighbors, family, people who've been the subject of years of abuse began to sing "Amazing Grace." How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Would you forgive tonight? That's love. It does not keep a record of wrongs. And thirdly and finally, love is compassionate. Love is compassionate. Time is not on my side, and I don't want us to be a preacher tonight. That's not my interest. But I would like to say this, that 2.5 years ago, I was alone in Singapore one night. Esther was in England. I didn't have any meeting that night. I had no meal. And I just was wondering what to do, and I went down to my favorite alfresco cafe in the center of Singapore, and I ordered my favorite food, sea bass. And I sat there waiting for the food to come when a little girl, a young girl, a young woman, came to me and said, "Excuse me, sir, would you like company for the night?" And I thought, well, what a nice invitation. You don't get that kind of invitation very often. And so I said to her, "Well, to be honest with you, I don't want company for the night, but I am alone, and I'd love to have a dinner companion. Would you have dinner with me? I'll pay for it." And so we had dinner together. I'm so glad none of the elders of our church came along that night. And I asked her her story. Why are you doing this? And she told me the most horrendous story. She told me that her sister had been married twice and had 4 children by her first 2 husbands, And they were in the Philippines, where she comes from. And then her sister, Teresa, had gone to America to marry her third husband and abandoned the children. And she said that she had just started her nursing training and was no longer able to continue because they couldn't afford to pay for it because of the situation. And her mother was looking after the four children. And she moved to Japan and she worked in a karaoke TV bar as a waitress where she earned money and she sent it back to the Philippines month by month to pay for her four nieces. And then she lost her visa to be in Japan after 4.5 years. And she went back to the Philippines and they were desperate because they had no money. And then somebody said, if you go to Singapore, there's lots of money there. And so she went to Singapore. And she is working for an escort agency. She's 27 years old. I'm going to give you her escort name tonight, but it's not her real name, it's Florence. And I said, Florence, do you enjoy doing what you're doing? And she said, I hate it. I totally hate it. I said, Florence, why don't you go back to the Philippines? She said, I can't. If I go back, there's no money, there's no job. What do I do? And she was obviously very upset. So I said to her, how much do you earn a night? She said, $1,000. Four customers, $250 each. I said, that's a lot of money, Florence. She said, the escort agency take 90%. And then she said, and when I can't come into the agency in the morning because I'm too tired, they fine me. And I get about $60 a day. And then she said, and I couldn't go back to the Philippines anyway because I owe the escort agency $500 for the airfare that paid me to come here. I said to her, if you had any ambition in life, what would you like to do? She said, I always wanted to be a nurse. And as I sat there, I said to her, Florence, if I paid for your airfare to go back to the Philippines, and if I paid the escort agency the $500 you owe them, and I would do it personally, and if I paid for your nursing training for the next 3 years, would you accept that? And she just sat there and began to cry. My wife and I have been to see her recently. She is now in her third and final year of nursing training. God is so good. There came a terrible text message one day. It said, Mum has died. Maybe I can't continue. And I prayed and the Lord said to me, don't send any more money. And then about 2 weeks later, another text message. Teresa in America, for the first time, and it's been the only time, has sent some money. And it's enough to pay the debts of Mum's funeral. And a little bit of the nieces, her children's schooling, I think I can carry on. And a few months later, another message, or it's an email actually. Dear Michael and Esther, I have decided to follow your Jesus. I want to know him. I'd never spoken about giving your life to Jesus. That wasn't my intention. You don't just care for people so that you can get something out of them, so that they become evangelical fodder. You care for them because you care, because you love, and you leave the consequences with God. Can you imagine the joy when I got another email? She said this, I have decided to work when I finish my nursing training in a government hospital. There's much more money in the private sector, but I want to work among the people who are my people. I mean, I just cried. Would you begin to reach out with encouragement, with forgiveness if necessary, and with compassion? You say, I can't. I understand. Darling, can I tell the story about, you know what I mean, Madura? I'll tell this to close. One night, one afternoon, my wife and I were on our bicycles. We were cycling through the area we lived. It's a fanatical Muslim area. We'd been sent there to plant a church in a Muslim community. And we were going to a village. And we were cycling. And I said to my wife, I'll give you a race. I was younger then. And and it was a very windy path. And I was winning. I was about 100 meters ahead when suddenly I heard a scream. Ah! And I recognize that scream anywhere. It's my wife. And I stopped and I ran back. And there she was on the ground. And seven young Muslim men had come out and they'd begun to attack her. And I saw her, and I can't claim to be brave because bravery counts the cost first. I didn't even think of the cost. I just ran like a white elephant and into the midst of these seven young Muslim men, and they all went off in different directions. And my wife was on the ground, and she was hysterical. And I got her home. And I want to tell you, over the next few weeks, my wife was not the woman I married. She was full of fear. She kept on saying, I want my mum. I want to go home. She's a missionary on the island of Madura, but she says, I don't like these people. And she'd wake up in the night with nightmares. And it looked like it would be the end of our career as missionaries in Indonesia. But it was on one Saturday morning, we knelt down, and I think the end had come, really. And Esther prayed, and I'll never forget the prayer. She said, Lord, I cannot love these people. It's impossible. But you love them, and I want you to love them through me. She said it was as though a bucket of warm water was being poured over her, and it went right through her whole body. And a couple of days later, I read this verse from Romans chapter 5 and verse 5, the love of God is poured into our hearts by the Holy Spirit given unto us. You may not be able to, but God will help you if your heart is for what he wants. I want to say to you from Jersey today, love one another. And from outside of Jersey, love one another. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy strength and with all thy mind. And the second commandment is like unto it, love thy neighbor as thyself. Encouraging, forgiving, and compassionate. I think I've said enough. Guy, I'm going to hand over to you because I don't quite know what to do next. I've gone as far as I know where to go.